Hello, and welcome to another episode of Boundless Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we have another amazing guest introduced to you now. Richard David Feynman, PhD, is a professor of cell biology at the State University of New York Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York, where he has been a pioneer in incorporating nutrition into the biochemistry curriculum. A graduate of the University of Rochester and the University of Oregon, Dr. Feynman has published numerous scientific and popular papers. Dr. Feynman is the founder and former co-editor-in-chief of the journal Nutrition and Metabolism. He's currently researching the adaptation and application of ketogenic diets to cancer. His book, The World Turned Upside Down, The Second Low-Carbohydrate Revolution, describes the science of carbohydrate restriction arising from a ragtag collection of popular diets and how the powerful low-fat army became the default approach to health. His latest version of that book is called Nutrition in Crisis, Flawed Studies, Misleading Advice, and the Real Science of Human Metabolism, and explains the intricacies of nutrition and human metabolism in accessible terms. He lays out the tools you need to navigate the current confusion in medical literature and its increasingly bizarre reflection in the media. Dr. Richard Feynman, what an absolute honor it is to welcome you to Boundless Body Radio.
It's great to be here.
It's such a joy to host you. You're somebody I followed for a very, very long time. I've respected you in this field for so long. I love your approach to, kind of your research and the way you disseminate information. It's funny the way you write. It's very serious the way that you write, but you explain it in a way that bums like me can understand. So I really appreciate that.
Well, it's very nice of you to say those things.
You're a very, very good writer.
A lot of people get you every place.
Well, you're a very good writer. Your book is great. Your Substack is fantastic. I love the title of the book, Nutrition in Crisis. Do you think that is over-exaggerating the issue that we have in the nutrition world right now, or do you think you're spot on by such a bold claim?
Well, it's very serious. I think it's very serious on several fronts. Most of all, for the patient. So we have a lot of publications from major institutions, and whereas they may have disclaimers, in essence, they are giving you medical advice, and it's not always good medical advice. And this appears right now in the sense that even obesity is primarily a psychological problem. We've known for a long time. People dispute this, but this tremendous data that body mass is not a real risk for health, except at the very extremes. But patients feel a loss of control. They don't have the control over their own body. People who are otherwise very successful in their life feel very frustrated by that. And most important right now is diabetes, because we have dietary, in particular, dietary controls that will put diabetes, type 2 diabetes, in remission, and will actually improve type 1 diabetes, despite the need for insulin. There's a risk to the patient in the future in that, in particular, the ketogenic diet that is being explored for cancer and for neurological pathologies is very promising. And I suppose that's used the way people talk about whatever their own particular field is. It's not clear which cancers and to what extent we will be successful at treating. But it's the way most people describe it now is the glass is more than half full. And we don't want to repress research now. Especially in that it's coming up with good results. So those are the threats. But it's also that the level of science is not good, and we're wasting money on poor science. Epidemiology is a a serious method of study, but it has very strict requirements if you're going to get anything out of it. If you are trying to do epidemiology, of course, relates a particular stimuli to outcome. And if you, for example, as it's successful, for example, if you wanted to bring a suit against the factory where you work because the atmosphere was full of some chemical that had caused that you think was causing your respiratory problems, you could bring epidemiologic evidence to the courts, and you would say that this is the correlation between the atmosphere of this compound with incidence of this respiratory disease. And you would show that there is very little of the compound anywhere else. And you would have to meet certain requirements, in particular that the comparison of the disease related to working in the factory compared to people who worked someplace else had to be very high. Courts usually insist on at least 2-1 unless you have some other point. If you try to do that with a health condition that has many factors and you want to focus on one, that's a blunt instrument. You're not going to get anywhere with that, and we shouldn't be spending a lot of money on it. And most of all, we're not meeting the requirements of good science practice. One of the themes in my Substack is that if we talk about evidence, we should see what we could learn from a court of law. And in a court of law, you have to have if you want to make a case for an association, a cause of a problem, you have to have exculpatory evidence. You're obligated to bring in stuff that goes against your hypothesis. It's known in the law courts as Brady material, because Brady was a guy who was convicted of murder, but it turned out that his accomplice was the guy who actually pulled the trigger. And the police knew that, but didn't reveal it at court. And his sentence was reduced when that came out. And the courts have ruled the police can't even look the other way. They have to seek out exculpatory evidence. And that's what we don't have. And the real problem in that part of the crisis is that we're not bringing good science to helping people.
Yeah. And it's like you say, the patient is the one that suffers at the end of the day, because they're getting wrong information or being overloaded with conflicting information. So let me see if I can set the table a little bit with this. You're talking about epidemiological studies, which is largely how nutrition science is done these days. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to study a large group of people and see if you can find any differences with the way things live and see if you can find some associations. This is not proof, but you want to find some strong evidence that, you know, something is causing something. You can't ever show that with epidemiology, but if your numbers are very, very big, you're on to something. So you mentioned a minimum of what we'd like to see, which is at least 2-1. If you can show something has double the likelihood of causing something, that's a start, that we can at least start to investigate that and see if there's not something else going on. This really paid off for us when it came to smoking, when we found that people that were smoking had like something like a 30 times greater likelihood of getting lung cancer. We're onto something as far as that goes. And that's kind of one of the biggest wins for epidemiology. epidemiology because it showed a very, very, very strong correlation. Now, it still wasn't causation. Well, you compare that to something like what the WHO came out and said about like red meat, and the numbers are not even close to statistically significant in any way. It's like they're showing a correlation of 1.15 or 1.17, which you can't even come to the table with that. Yet the headline still says red meat causes cancer, is likely to cause cancer, is carcinogenic. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's more than that. It's the basic attitude. One of the other themes in my Substack is that, well, the way I describe it is an introduction to a statistics book, which says what we try to do in statistics is we try to put a number on our intuition, which is a good enough description. What's wrong with the, not just nutrition, but some medical literature, is that it's got that all backwards. It looks at the statistics and it tries to develop an intuition. And what that means is it's missing the basic idea that what you do in science is you have an intuition about what it means. There is the idea that actually successful scientists have some brains, you know, that there is something to being a scientist. So there are disclaimers in saying that associations are not causation, and you have to be careful. I mean, that's true, of course. But the better way to say it is associations do not necessarily imply causation. In the case of the smoking, they very strongly imply causation, absolutely. And there are several reasons for it. One is that it makes sense. And as you say, the numbers are big. But more important, cigarette smoke is not a terrific danger for all kinds of things. It's a real danger for lung cancer, and it's a substantial danger for heart disease, but not as much. And that makes sense. The problem is that my grand insight into the actual applications as we see it, in other words, the science and the medicine that's published, is the difference between science and medicine is that in science, doubt is an opportunity. In medicine, doubt is a threat. And that's a very serious problem. And I'll give you an example of what, in other words, if things don't go well in science, then you try to find out the answer. In medicine, that's a problem. I'll give you an example of what it's really like in science. This is people now know about Oppenheimer. And at the end of his life, of course, he was attacked for communist associations, which were not true. My guess is that he went to the communist party meetings to meet girls. But whatever it was, he was not much of a interested in communism. But he was attacked for that later on, primarily because I think he was at some point opposed the hydrogen bomb. In any case, Edward R. Murrow, who of course is one of the early great broadcasters, was doing a story about the Oppenheimer scandal. He actually did lose his security clearance, which is a serious mistake on the country's part. But in any case, so Edward R. Murrow went to the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And so he talked to people. He talked to Oppenheimer, and he talked to various people there. And he met with the head of the Institute. And at some point he said, you know, this is the goddamnedest place. And Spiller said, why do you say that? And he says, well, this is supposed to be the pinnacle of intellectual activity in the United States. And I've never heard so many people say, I don't know. And that's the problem. If you're a physician, it's very hard if the patient's sitting there to say you don't know. And And really, that's why we so often respect physicians. A few of us want that responsibility. So that's really a lot of where I see the problem. And of course, what the courts, the idea of evidence in the courts is to get away from the idea that they, what they call general acceptance, which means the general acceptance of experts, and it usually means institutions. And that's the problem. We're burdened with institutions who were very reactionary.
Wow. That's so interesting. This is why we love and appreciate those like yourself with super scientific minds who come into the field of nutrition, and you're used to science being an opportunity, like you described. Like, if you find out, that's a good thing. You're always trying to disprove your theories, and you're always trying to investigate further. And that just doesn't seem to happen with medicine. So I think that's a very poignant example. And I like in your book how you kind of write about the history of all of this. You talk about like the first carbohydrate revolution and, you know, how all of this kind of came to be. How did we get into this space where there's such a vast difference, again, between medical science and, you know, what you were taught with chemistry and biochemistry and all that stuff? Where did we get so lost here?
It's very hard to say. I don't really know. Interesting is I was just actually listening to the Audible version of Gary Taub's new book on rethinking diabetes.
So good.
And It's very interesting. A lot of people might actually benefit from reading the last two chapters first, because it tells you where we are. And then the beginning is a very good description of how we got there. But it doesn't answer the question, which is, what went wrong with our thinking? And I mean, Gary's a very good writer, and he answers the question that people say, for example, in the theater, they say, can you show a scene that's very boring, that's describing boredom, but not make the presentation boring so that the audience can watch it, but they know they're watching something boring? In that particular case, I always cite the best example of Moneyball, which is a book about baseball and statistics, and it's really and it's really interesting.
That's a good point.
Gary addressed this. What he really did is accurately describe a situation that is a very serious scandal, but did it on the one hand didn't cover it up. He really brought it out, but not in a in such an emotional way that you can't understand the details that he brings out. So I thought that was a great accomplishment. Of course, the you just go on YouTube and you'll see that there are people who are really hurt by this and have a very serious reaction. So I can't answer your question. I don't know whether anybody can. There's no, it's hard to say what the motivations are. I think the major motivation is a subset of the difference of we don't like to admit that we made a mistake. And nobody has that problem more than physicians.
Yeah.
And my father was a physician, and his joke was that if a lawyer takes a book off the shelf, his fee goes up. If a doctor takes a book off his shelf, his fee goes down. You're supposed to know everything. And that's not entirely reasonable. But before I forget this thought, the other side of the original question you asked is that there is a terrific opportunity, I think, because within the literature, which has so many problems, there are many good studies, and we're doing good work on, from our end, low carbohydrate ketogenic diets. It's not adequately appreciated, and people are not taking advantage of it adequately. And there's the social media, the stuff that you're doing, and all the social media have done. In fact, as I recall, original stimulus for contacting you is you did a great interview with Nina Teicholz, and so the overall facts. There is a positive side to it. There are a lot of opportunities. Unfortunately, the onus of information is put on the patient. But at least we have the opportunity. So I think that's the flip side of the confusion.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's not always easy to parse out the differences between those things. You mentioned that, you know, we're maybe asking an unanswerable question when we talk about things like how did we get to where we are today? And you do get a sense from some of these writers like yourself and Gary Taubes and Nina, who you just mentioned, that it wasn't really anything that was just on purpose. It was, you know, just this chain of events of scientists falling in love with their own ideas, and somehow money and politics got involved, and then the government got involved. And then, you know, there's now incentives for, you know, keeping somebody prescribed, I mean, to medications and doing medical procedures. And I always just think too, like, when I get really interested in something, I want to learn all about it. So over a decade ago, I learned how to brew beer, and I didn't care about chemistry, and I didn't care about temperature conversions or engineering. But in that process of when I was doing that, again, over a decade ago, like, I had to learn all of those things. A few years ago, I got more interested in Formula One, and I'm not interested in aerodynamics or, you know, how rubber and tire compounds work. But if you're interested in Formula One, you have to learn all those things. And it's the same that I've had to go through, you know, in the process of just being a trainer, nutrition coach. And like, you get interested in nutrition, well, you have to know statistics, like you write about. You have to know how to get into these studies. And even after doing this for as long as I've done it, like, it's tough. And so to go back and imagine somebody just on the street, just getting a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, and here's your insulin and metformin, and good luck, we're going to, you know, manage this as it gets worse over time. It you're right. It's terrible for the patient, and they're not getting any real good advice. And the headlines keep coming out. I mean, just even in the last few weeks, the American Diabetes Association saying how to divide your plate up and make sure that a quarter of your plate is starches like rice and bread and pasta. You know, we had this ridiculous thing come out of the American Heart Association about fasting causing 91% increase in death by heart attacks. And there's nothing behind it. There's no like real data that you can see. It's ridiculous. And again, you're so right. It's the poor patients that just suffer with all of this nonsense.
I laugh because it struck me there's a thing possibly for American Heart now that it saying that fiber is good for the microbiome, and they've, you know, it always struck me that a traditional medicine, at least the at least the official position, has always emphasized fiber, which is the nutrient that doesn't give you any nutrition.
Good point.
And they're also emphasizing fasting, which doesn't give you anything at all. And it reminded me of Rodney Dangerfield's joke. He said he went to a strip club because it advertised topless and bottomless. There was nobody there.
That's good.
So, you know, they're dodging the fact by just about removing everything that's is a real nutrient.
Wow. Yeah, at the last conference I was at, Peter Ballerstedt was showing a slide that came from our dietary recommendations from the government, and it showed like the non-nutrient dense version of a food compared to the nutrient dense version of a food. And one of them was frosted mini wheats was not nutrient dense, but regular mini wheats was nutrient dense. And it got down to where it was soda was not nutrient dense, but sparkling water was nutrient dense. How is sparkling water nutrient dense?
That's great. Well, yeah, we. I guess you can absorb carbon dioxide.
I guess so. It tastes good. I won't argue that it tastes good.
Yeah, well, that's part of the problem is that we don't have the standards that you have in hard science. And this is, you know, partly our gang, too. I mean, we... I'm not, I mean, I've been able to lose friends and not influence people by giving people a hard time on ultra-processed food. But, you know, it's a term that doesn't mean anything. It's, but that, you know, that's what we're up here. I mean, nutrient dense, the first time I heard that, well, my background is in chemistry. So I got into nutrition from teaching biochemistry to medical students. And we had some pressure from a student who had been a dietitian, and she produced this stuff that she thought should be in the course. And it was, I don't remember anything about it. It wasn't very good, but most of all, it wasn't biochemistry. And as the way I always describe it is this, you complain about the lectures, everybody sees an immediate solution. So I wound up having to give lectures on nutrition, which was not my field, you know, except what was basic in biochemistry. And my own nutrition was, I always knew that low carbohydrate diets were much better for me. And partly, you know, I'm an old dog. We didn't have any of this food pyramid when I was growing up. Everybody knew that starch would make you fat. So anyway, I had to learn nutrition from a professional standpoint, and it didn't take me long to see that it was a total crock. Different than saying there wasn't good work in it, but you know, they were floating in a sea of craziness, and mostly around. Heart disease and the cholesterol hypothesis. And I mean, I was actually working in blood coagulation, which is very closely related. And it didn't make any sense. It didn't fit in. And it's still not being adequately the two processes. Blood coagulation is distinctly related to the problems of heart disease.
Yep.
So that's how I got into this. And again, it's a problem that we're not using standards that would be used in normal science.
Yeah.
You know, And part of that problem, one thing that you can definitely put your finger on, is the proliferation of journals, and that's because of being able to publish them online, which it doesn't cost anything. Electrons and holes are cheap, and it doesn't cost it. And they figured out a way to make the author pay. What that means is that there's tremendous competition, not to be published, but rather to find authors that you can publish. And that's got to reduce standards, which it has. I mean, it's been terrible.
Wow. Wow. Very interesting. Well, you mentioned some of your history with learning some of this stuff. And I do want to ask you, what was that like? I mean, with more of a biochemical background, once you started learning about nutrition, I mean, what was that like? Just lights going on everywhere? Like, oh, the direction that we are going as a country, as a society, is completely the wrong way. It sounds like you were able to see that very, very quickly. And I mean, alongside that, was that understanding the process of ketogenesis itself? Like, was that a big part of understanding that, oh, this is a very natural and almost like preferred metabolic state for the body? What was it like to kind of be learning about that and then, you know, also seeing like the dissonance between what you were learning and where we were heading as a culture?
Yeah, well, as I said, I personally knew that carbohydrates would make me fat. I was always fighting fat. I was never, from the pictures, I was never obese or even very fat, but that was always an obsession. So I knew about carbohydrates, but the truth is most of us didn't know about ketones. I myself didn't appreciate it. And all of us didn't, because it came into our view from the pathology. We saw ketone bodies as associated with untreated type 1 diabetes. It wasn't understood that ketone bodies are more than the problem of not having enough insulin. Kind of capsule description of ketogenesis is that it has to do with the primacy of insulin as a master hormone. Now, that's of course exaggerated. The way I describe it is that metabolism is like American football. There's at least 22 different things going on at once. But if you don't know, the best thing you can do is follow the quarterback. And that's what they do on TV. And you can see sometimes they get faked out. And one of the running backs actually has the ball. But generally, if you don't have information, insulin is the controlling variable. And what insulin does primarily is it's anabolic. It increases the storage of glucose, it increases the storage of fat, and it is primarily targeting fat breakdown. So, fats are converted to fatty acids and glycerol. Fatty acids are the actual fuel. And under conditions of starvation, or where there's very little carbohydrate, insulin is going to go down. Insulin will allow fat to produce fatty acids. Fatty acids will be your primary fuel. Now, let me step back one step. The way I teach metabolism is that there are two fuels, and that's glucose and fat. And there are two goals of metabolism. One is to provide enough energy in the form of ATP, and the other is to maintain blood glucose at a constant level for those cells that require a brain and central nervous system. So under conditions where there's no glucose, you have a problem with the providing the glucose for those tissues that require it. And the big idea in metabolism as it applies to this problem is you can't make glucose from fat. You know, there are small exceptions, you know, fat contains glycerol, but that's the major factor. So the first of the goals of metabolism, we all have enough fat to provide energy. If you have no food, you can live for weeks or even months just on what you've stored. The problem is, how are you going to provide the glucose? And the way you do that is to use other metabolites, primarily protein, primarily under conditions of starvation. You're going to break down body protein to supply amino acids, which can be converted to glucose. The way that evolution has ameliorated that problem is by providing a secondary fuel from fatty acids. And as the fatty acids get broken down, they can also produce the ketone bodies, which the brain can use. The fatty acids themselves do not generally cross the blood-brain barrier. So what you have is you now have a cycle. Fatty acids get stored if there's insulin there. If insulin goes down, then the fatty acids are produced. They will give you both energy, and they can give you ketone bodies, which will substitute for protein. One of the features of ketone bodies is that they can stimulate the release of insulin. So insulin will now go back and turn off the source of fatty acids in ketone bodies. So it's, you know, low insulin, produce fatty acids, produce ketones, ketones produce insulin, turn off the fatty acids. So it's a cycle, and that's what it is that keeps your, when there's no food, it keeps your ketone bodies at a constant level or up to a maximum level. In type 1 diabetes, where the patient does not make insulin, then they're in danger of overproducing ketone bodies. And the ketone bodies are acids. So at some point, you're going to have an acidosis, and specifically ketoacidosis, and that's the threat. The real threat of starvation, again, the threat of starvation is not energy. It's the threat to protein, the breakdown of your body protein. And you, if you can produce insulin as under normal conditions, that will give you a leg up. If you can't produce enough insulin, then the threat becomes ketoacidosis. And that was the original, I think, the major threat of type 1 diabetes before the discovery of insulin.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know whether I answered a question, but that's the picture.
No, that was fantastic. And Gary Taubes, again, writing extensively about that in Rethinking Diabetes, how that all came about, and what a horrible disease type 1 diabetes is. You're just like wasting away because you don't have that control. There's nothing to kind of turn off that loop. But when you don't have type 1 diabetes and everything is working in this way, it's so very elegant. It's really beautiful to hear about how the process controls itself and just make sure there's a steady amount of fuel that never goes too high or too low. The protein synthesis is very awesome. You hear this all the time, and you also see anecdotes of people that do very low carbohydrate diets. They're doing ketogenic diets. Maybe they're doing intermittent fasting, and they are in a state of ketosis. They can measure it, and they are supposedly generating enough blood glucose that they need from the protein themselves. But you also see that until somebody gets to the later stages of starving, they're not necessarily losing muscle mass per se. They're using protein, but it can also come from other sources and not just from the muscles. Otherwise, we might see somebody fast for, you know, a month if they had plenty of body fat. You would assume that they wouldn't just waste away as far as their muscle mass. That would only happen later on. Is that because they're using that protein from somewhere else?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the thing is that the threat of starvation is that you don't have the protein either. So you have to break down body protein. So that under normal conditions, a ketogenic diet will be described as protein sparing, give you a leg up. But for therapy, you put in protein yourself. It's protein's in the diet, so you don't have to worry about that. And that gives you control. That's why even with the mass of all the stuff that's not really appreciated, common sense tells you that people with type 1 diabetes can be on a ketogenic diet, even though it sounds crazy, as long as they have insulin or some other control. Because if you usually attributed to Dr. Bernstein that the rule of low numbers, if you don't have much glucose, then you don't have to worry about how much trouble it is to deal with that as a deficit in insulin production is much easier. And finally, people are beginning to say this. Belinda Leonard, who works with David Ludwig, actually, analyzed what people were doing with this, but it should have been intuitively obvious. And the patients know that. Well, that's one of the that's the most underappreciated source of information is the patients. And we have all of their comments on social media. And that's just very poorly analyzed. I mean, of course, personal opinion, personal perceptions have to be analyzed for their own inherent error in what they're saying. But one of the other things is we don't know what anybody's eating. An anomaly is so far out that American Diabetes Association, this is a proposition I haven't really tested much. I tested a little bit. You go through the recommendations of the American Diabetes Association and search on ketogenic, even search on low carbohydrate. There's very little very little information, and all of the medical journals are not they're not addressing ketogenic diets. Well, is anybody on a ketogenic diet? Well, so here's an interesting datum. Kellogg is bringing out a line of keto cereals.
I didn't know that.
You know that, yeah. And the main thing that tells you is there's a great market for them. And my own guess that we just don't have this much information is that keto is popular because people try it. Try to get into ketosis, and which is pretty hard to do. And they discover that if they don't hit it, in other words, if they're actually measuring their ketone bodies, they may see that they don't hit it. But when you do that, you've so dramatically reduced carbohydrates that's so beneficial for most people that they don't mind calling themselves keto people. So I think it's nobody knows. My guess is it's had a big effect. People have actually been successful. Well, people were very successful with the Atkins diet, which was had a phase that was the first 2 weeks of the Atkins diet was a ketogenic diet.
That's right.
And most of us, including me, underappreciated I underappreciated the ketogenic part. And somebody asked me at a conference why after 2 weeks you add carbohydrates back, and I didn't have a good answer for that. I didn't even realize when I first got into it that Jeff Bullock was already on a ketogenic diet before anybody ever said the word. And it took me longer to get into it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to contemplate that is happening, that you are seeing more keto products and companies that are bringing that to the table. And you wonder, like, well, that sucks that they're profiting off of these things, but also exactly what you said, like, if they're recognizing that there's a marketing benefit because people are finding this, you know, not through the conventional way, but they're finding it in different ways, you wonder if that's actually, like, a good thing. So it's interesting, especially as you sit down and you ponder the plight of these people that we're talking about, the patients who are getting so much conflicting information. They're watching the Netflix, the documentaries without reading the studies and understanding, you know, what is being sold to them as a bill of goods and what is the actual study saying. So people have it tough out there. What advice would you want to give to a patient when they're trying to understand all this stuff? Is it the common sense that you mentioned, like, to really kind of think it out and understand, like, if I'm eating a lot of carbohydrates, I'm gaining a lot of weight, I don't feel that great. How are people to make sense of all this stuff that's coming out all the time?
Well, you know, if they come to me, I'll point them to things that I think are telling the story. And that's what's required is, you know, education. And my own feeling, and I'm just trying to attack this now, is that we're under, a lot of people are undereducated in basic science. I think it's great that the discussions in diet now are substantially biochemical, but people don't have a good understanding, or many people don't, of the overall picture of chemistry and biochemistry. And so I'm undertaking probably very soon start my Substack of starting from scratch of teaching about atoms and molecules and the chemistry. And what I'm doing, it will be unique in that I will jump into organic chemistry right away. See, now, the term organic chemistry refers to the chemistry of carbon atoms. Yeah, it used to mean, you know, biological chemistry, but organic now includes polyethylene or anything that has carbon. But for some reason, there's this folk myth in colleges that organic chemistry is hard. And I don't know why, because basically organic chemistry is easy compared to freshman chemistry, which was very hard, because it, you know, has much more mathematical and physics in it. I have a lot of experience. I like teaching stuff at the basic level because I think partly because when you are in professional training, you tend not to ask questions that are very basic, because you're trying to get to the frontiers of research. You're trying to, that's unfortunate. You know, you don't have the opportunity to be curious. I mean, that's the people interview, you know, Nobel Prize winners and scientists and want to know what it takes to be a scientist. And the most common answer you get is to stay curious. Mm. And the only other part of it, which they say among themselves and less likely, is you got to hang in there. You cannot get depressed. If it were known, it wouldn't be research. and you have to deal with failure. Anything that goes wrong, you have to take that as information for the next step. And those are the two things. That's all it takes. I can't honestly say how well I do those two things myself, but but that's it. So I think back actually to why I never asked when I was actually for some time why it is that the nucleus of the atom is packed with protons, which are all positively charged. Positive charges repel each other. Why doesn't the nucleus fall apart? And of course it does if you don't have the nuclear strong force. It's called radioactivity. But I never questioned that. I think I did admit, I was eager to charge ahead and learn everything I could. Didn't stop to ask those questions. And of course, there's a price to pay for being too curious. I got into nutrition. A lot of it was based on a calorie is a calorie. Yep. And people cited thermodynamics. And they said that the so-called metabolic advantage, is what it was called when you lost more weight per calorie on the Atkins diet or any low carbohydrate diet. They said that would violate laws of thermodynamics. And of course, they didn't know what they were talking about. Those of us who've studied thermodynamics or teach it tried to jump it. That's how I got into this. I felt sure I could help everybody straighten it out because I knew a little bit about thermodynamics. Very few chemists want to claim expertise unless they're really physical chemists. Being in nutrition, I've learned a lot of things, and there's been some discouragement. But one thing is I actually learned some thermodynamics because thinking back to studying it in graduate school, I always remember thinking that it's a very difficult subject. I remember thinking, if I try to understand this, I'm never going to get the problem sets done. So, that's what it takes to get through, graduate school. So I got an opportunity to go back and try to understand thermodynamics. And it's an unusual subject because it's one that where even physicists admit they don't really understand it. Partly because it's not a true molecular science. You have to have a lot of atoms, and then you have to do the underlying physics of thermodynamics is called statistical mechanics. And there you ask, what will the actual effect of having all these atoms in these different states? So it's, the key idea of that comes out of thermodynamics is the concept of entropy, that organization and information. And so it becomes a semantic problem whether there's such a thing as the entropy of a single atom. You have to have a bunch of them before you can have entropy. So that's...
Well, I think this has been an awesome conversation. I really enjoy how you gave that advice to the listener, the patients themselves, that they want to stay curious, keep chasing, ask questions. I think it's really, really important to take that scientific mindset. And I'm so looking forward to your Substack. I love reading them already. So to be able to go back and learn some of those basics from you is going to be amazing. So I, for one, think you do a great job educating people about that. And I know it's a huge passion of yours. Dr. Feynman, this was such an honor to be able to chat with you today. Where would you like people to go to find you and connect with you and your work?
What I always say about my book is that it took a while to write. And it took several years, and it's published a couple of years ago, and so I don't remember everything that is in it. And I was reading it recently, and it's pretty good. I recommend it. So they can, they can get the book. Substack is, and also I, even some of the technical articles I write, I do shoot for making it easier to understand. I don't know how successful I am, but I am on the mission to teach organic chemistry by teaching you nutrition and biochemistry. So I'm going to start that any day now on Substack. And so if you know what H2O is, or even if you don't, you can start right there. No prerequisites. Well, wow. One prerequisite. You have to understand exponential notation. You have to know that 10 to the 2 is called 10 square, and it's 10 times 10. And you have to know all the variations of that, because that's part of the language. And everybody will use it. I mean, people try to say, you know, a billion, billion, billion. And it doesn't actually bother me, except I can't imagine what that would be.
Right. Right.
Okay, so that's, so look for that.
Great, that's awesome. We will link to all of that in the show notes. I will definitely be looking forward to that. I love your teaching style, and yeah, everything you've done in your career to be able to disseminate that down again to bums like me is just really important. So thank you so very much for taking the time to come on our show today, and thank you for writing your book and all your Substack articles. We really appreciate you.
Okay, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. It was definitely an honor. And this has been another episode of Boundless Body Radio. As always, thank you so very much for listening to Boundless Body Radio. Hosting this podcast is seriously one of the most meaningful and joyous parts of my life. Even after 600 episodes of our show, I still get nervous before every interview that I do. But it does just bring me such joy to share some of my favorite people, the people that have taught me so much over the years, and to invite them on and ask them questions, and then to share that with you, the listener, is a super cool experience. I hope you've enjoyed the content of the show so far this year. I tried to start the year off with a mix of new guests and returning guests, some that are practically household names in the health and wellness space, and some inspiring people that may not be very well known now, but are certainly doing amazing work wherever they are. I'm just so grateful for all of our incredible guests. Remember that you can always go to our website to book a complimentary 30-minute session with us at myboundlessbody.com. On our homepage, one of the first things you'll see is a Book Now button where you can select a time to speak with us about your personal health and fitness plan. We don't have any set packages, products, supplements, or anything like that to sell you. People that do want to work with us simply pay for the time that they want, and that's about it. We've loved chatting with so many of you out there to bounce ideas off each other and try to offer any advice that we can. And seriously, as always, even if you book a spot just to say hello and introduce yourself, we absolutely love connecting with you, the listener, and our community. Be sure to check out our YouTube channel, which is also growing quite a bit, if you want to watch these full interviews and also shorter videos on more specific topics taken from these interviews as well. It's a fun way to interact with people who comment. We read and reply to every single YouTube comment we get, so be sure to subscribe to our channel and leave as many comments as you like. And of course, if you haven't already, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple. It is still the best way to make sure that the podcast gets out to more listeners. It only takes a moment to leave a review, and it's extremely meaningful to us. Cheers, and thank you again for listening to Boundless Body Radio.